Conscious leadership is like being the captain of a ship. Just as a captain is responsible for navigating the vessel towards its destination, a mindful leader is responsible for steering the organization towards its goals while considering the greater good. To be a conscious leader means to be aware of the impact of one's actions, decisions, and behaviors on the people and the planet. It means leading with empathy, compassion, and a sense of purpose. It means embracing diversity and inclusion and creating a culture of transparency and accountability. But why do we need to have conscious conversations? Just as a ship cannot reach the destination without the captain communicating with the crew and making informed decisions based on the conditions and circumstances, an organization cannot thrive without leaders having open and honest conversations with their employees, customers, and stakeholders. Conscious conversations are meaningful because they allow us to understand each other's perspectives, build trust, and collaborate towards a common goal. They enable us to identify the issues that matter most and find ways to address them constructively and meaningfully. In today's world, where social, environmental, and economic challenges are becoming increasingly complex and interconnected, we need conscious leadership and conscious conversations more than ever. We need leaders who are willing to take a stand for what is right, committed to creating positive change, and can inspire and empower others to do the same. So delve into the world of conscious leadership and explore the power of conscious conversations. We'll hear from experts, thought leaders, and change makers making a difference in their organization and communities. We'll learn about the challenges, the strategies, and lessons they have learned along the way. Together, we can create a world where conscious leadership and conversations are the norms, where businesses and organizations are driven by a sense of purpose and a commitment to making a positive impact. So let's sail on this journey of discovery and let's navigate towards a better future for all. Welcome, my name is Carmen Murray and I'm your host and the founder of Conscious Lead Hers. Now it gives me great pleasure to welcome you to the brand new flagship segment, the Status Update, the trusted home where decision makers get their update. This is your inside track to business, leadership and change. It's where Africa's forward-facing conversations unfold. This is where businesses get briefed. Today, we're diving into the state of women in STEM in Africa, a subject that is not just about inclusion, it's about innovation, infrastructure, and the future of this continent. You know, only 28% of professionals in STEM fields actually globally are women. And in Africa, the numbers are even lower. But the real urgency, when women are not part of the equation, the code, the algorithms, and the solutions that shape our world, it leaves out half of the population. This isn't just a gender issue, it's an economic one. It's a future of Africa issue. So why STEM? Why women? Why now? Because the future isn't being built, and Africa cannot afford to build it with half of its potential. Let's unpack what's really going on, what's shifting, and what still needs to be done on the ground and in the boardrooms and in code itself. And with us in studio today is Nyari Samushonga from We Think Code. Welcome.
Thank you.
And also we've got Rakeshni Ramotar Prishal, Director of the University of Pretoria and Acting Deputy Director of Science. Is that correct?
I just finished my term, 2-year term at the Department of Science, Technology and Innovation.
Welcome. I'm so thrilled. And as this is, as a status update, we've all got our notes. We are prepared for this because we want to bring you facts and inform you about this topic today. Before we even get started, Nyari, talk to me about what it is that you're doing on the ground. What is your day-to-day life look like in the world of STEM? And Rakeshni, if you can do the same.
I think the way I would look at it or describe it is I'm busy with primarily two things. One is building software solutions, which I love to do, innovate and make problems go away. And the other is building people that build software solutions. So essentially, recruiting young people into training in software engineering with a particular focus on young women and a focus on young women coming from communities that are underprivileged who traditionally don't get included within the world of software technology, but are genuinely the majority of youthful women in South Africa. Mm. And so that's my world, is how do we find these young women? How do we get them excited about software and technology? How do we equip them with both the hardcore skills of building and engineering and the confidence and the self-esteem to walk into places and make their mark on the world? And then when they've done that, partner with them to actually build the software.
I love that. It's beautiful. Oh, build the people, build the technology that will build Africa. Yes.
In a nutshell.
Okay, Ashley.
So at the University of Pretoria, I've just shifted roles. I was part of research capacity development, and the large focus was on early career academics, strengthening their career, helping them move from the one degree to the next so that they get the requisite qualifications to compete, you know, globally. You know, it's that doctorate holds a lot of power. And so a lot of focus therein has been on women in science. Mm. And that's where my passion started. If I can, I'll share a story.
Yeah.
When I first arrived in that portfolio, I remember I was chasing reports. Where did the money go? Who did it support? How did it support somebody? And there was a young girl, postdoc actually, in her early 30s. And I'm like, where are you, Ponto? Please answer the call. Give me a report. I've been emailing you. I've been emailing your HOD, your dean. Just help me get the report. And the one morning I walk into the office and there's this young lady waiting outside my reception area. And she says, it's me. I'm Ponto. So I said, oh, great to meet you. And I could see she's drained. So I was like, oh, I'm sorry I've been giving you a hard time. But you know how these funders are with their deadline. And she said to me, I come from a home where we struggled to get me to study. I got all the requisite bursaries and I've studied from undergrad to honors to masters to doctoral. I'm now in postdoc and I'm in my 30s. I just had a baby. When do I take time out from my career to honor my personal journey? Do you know how that shifted, that discourse, that conversation, that room I had? Sure. Chills up my spine. And I said to her, you know what? You've inspired me. And she is the person that continues to inspire me as I started the Women in Science program. So my portfolio now has shifted to internationalization and strategic partnerships. And one of the key roles is about driving impact home. So much research happens at universities, but how do we deploy it into what we call the district development model? Mm. What are we taking to drive solutions that better our communities, especially rural areas, to empower the youth and learners, you know, modernizing sectors like agriculture or mining, bringing everyone on board, especially women? And I think there's so much to be done.
Yeah.
But we can keep scratching at it until we tackle it one by
100%. I mean, I myself come out of a technology background in the marketing space. Look, I mean, we as connected marketers, we deal with customer experiences. We deal with all of that. But in particular, I come from a mobile perspective. I come out of the mobile industry, but I've never been on the other side of it. I've always been the one, you know, let's come up with the innovation, the ideas, and let's put it out to the market. And this is how the UX works. And this is what we need to get done. And this is KPIs. Right. But now I'm on the other side of consuming it as well. And from a conscious leader's perspective and looking at what's happening on a global stage, I'm like, hang on, I need to start digging. What would the world look like without women in STEM? That we can actually really understand things that are happening right now. And this is not, this is just the tip of the iceberg. We only have a certain amount in studio. Otherwise, this could be like a 20-part series. But I'm just going to start and I'm going to read through various insights that's going to help you to understand the challenges that we deal with. So let's take the first one. And I really want us to paint a picture of this problem of women in STEM, what surprises you, what's not surprising you, and what challenges you are seeing. But let me open. So tech bias that hurts women. Let's talk about crash test dummies. They're based on male models. They only found out recently. I think women are 73% more likely to be seriously injured in a car crash. Then voice recognition tech underperforms for women. So studies have systems like Google and Apple assistants are significantly less accurate with female voices. AI hiring tools have already discriminated against women. Amazon scrapped its AI recruitment tool because it downgraded resumes with the word woman in it. Medical systems that ignore women. Clinical trials still underrepresented for women. Dosages and the side effects are often based on male biology, leading to misdiagnosis and dangerous treatments. Women's pain is underestimated. In ERs, women wait longer for pain meds and are more likely to be misdiagnosed, especially in heart attacks. Algorithms reinforce inequality. Social media AI amplifies polarization. Studies have shown that algorithms prioritize outrage, yet women in tech ethics are underrepresented in shaping these systems, which we're always talking about. Facial recognition falls for women of color, or fails for women of color. MIT research showed error rates up to 35% for black women compared to less than 1% for white men. That's scary. Still used in policing.
Sure. Mm.
The innovation economy is missing half the picture. Only 2% of global venture capital goes to women. So the next big idea is solving women's challenges, often underfunded and ignored. I know that this is a big conversation happening with G20 at the moment. Tech products still reflect male-dominated teams, from fitness trackers that ignore menstrual cycles to health apps without maternal health features. Polarization grows when STEM lacks empathy. Now, that word empathy has lost its meaning, but it is so important. AI tools trained on biased data reflect societal gaps. And when only one group controls the inputs, the outputs reinforce inequality. Deepfake technology is used disproportionately to target women. Women are the subjects of over 90% of deepfake content. Without women shaping digital policy, this abuse is going to escalate. This isn't a diversity issue. It's a design flaw in the future. And it's happening right now. So if we don't solve this problem of having more women in STEM, we are going to enter a very challenging time. So ladies, please take the floor. Nyari, I'm going to start with you.
Yeah. I think you paint a scary picture. And even as I listen to the picture, you touch on a lot of data-based technologies. So whenever we speak of AI and an algorithm, especially immediately, my mind goes to what is the data that was used to train these models that then in turn project. And you speak of the underrepresentation of women in those technologies. But when you then zoom in and say it's an underrepresentation of women in general, if I then check that data and say how many women in Africa are in that data, women in Africa from low-income households are in that data. Women in Africa from low-income households that are rural-based are in that data. Increasingly, we get to a point where they are not statistically significant for their stories to manifest in how the model makes decisions.
Yes.
And yet that is what is shaping our world. And so it's an existential crisis. There's a moment with generative AI where we all looked and said, oh my God, this changes everything. Mm. And moments like that are important because they're an opportunity to change everything.
Yeah.
It's a crisis that changes everything, but it's an opportunity that changes everything because it means we can do things differently. And so when you talk about the statistics of in Africa, less than 20% of women are in software engineering technical roles. And then you go further and you say 2% of women are receiving venture capital funding. And then if I say those 2% of women receiving venture capital funding, what is their background? What is their training? So if necessity is the mother of invention, and African women do not have the tools of invention, who is building the solutions that meet their needs? Who is building the innovations that solve for where they are? Yeah. And the answer is, we have a crisis. And essentially, the criticality of literacy at all levels, literacy of consumers and understanding that this thing you're using was not made with information and context that thought you mattered. literacy in building so that we have more young women sitting at the table and dictating what solutions we get is of critical importance. And when you look at what tech is now, you know, 20, 30 years ago, the software engineers were probably in a basement. Their role was contained. Now, if you think of the number of times you engaged digital technology from the moment you woke up, the alarm on your phone, possibly, to your drive to work, what is the temperature outside, to your, you know, wearable that's telling you what's happening with your heart rate and what have you, to your banking, to how you shop. We don't even go to the supermarket anymore. You start to realize that our whole lives, whatever business you're in the business of technology. So like you say, this isn't a diversity issue that is a problem for the young woman in a village in Africa. This is a problem for every business person who's trying to do business profitably and ethically. It's a problem for every father, every mother, every parent, every sister to say, our world needs to serve us and meet us where we are.
Yeah.
And it demonstrably does not do that right now.
Yeah.
And I would say that's the problem.
Yeah. And I just want to add to that, if we look at what's happening on the global stage right now, there's this perception about Africa being the stepchild, being the poor child. But it's not who we are. It is not at all who we are. But if you just, let's just take a something that everybody in our audiences can relate to. Have you ever thought about, why is it that people that live in America always get famous? That algorithms serves people, and people's voices are heard there, and the algorithm is in favor of Americans, whether we like it or not. So these people down here that are putting together amazing content, and there's so much discussion around TikTok about, oh my gosh, you must see how incredible the South Africans are. They got such a sense of humor. They are hysterical. Yeah. They put such great content out. Why have I never come across the information on my pages? And it's, that is a critical issue. And also, we as South Africans, when we perform, we have to pay to be seen. And furthermore, is that people are people will never get to those numbers because of where they're positioned and where they are in a specific country. And they don't get compensated if they do perform well. We are one of the countries that don't get paid, or our
content
creators don't get paid. So this is a conversation that you need to start thinking, well, surely there needs to be technology that's designed for Africans. And then we take women very seriously here.
Yes.
And if we take women very seriously, maybe that will shift, and will shift something for the rest of the world.
Yeah.
I'm going to add to that. The challenge here is about critical mass. And where is the critical mass nurtured? And that's the university sector. And we find that, as an example, in STEM globally, we have less than 30% of women that are STEM graduates. Yet in Africa, we have close to 50%. It sits at 47%. So we are feeding the world, and the world has an aging workforce. We are at the most prestigious and potentially rich space because of our youth dividend. So when we are nurturing STEM, we are not nurturing STEM just for the here and now and solutions for today, but for future generations. So what does it look like in terms of a woman's voice being heard across the globe? Well, of the top 200 universities, as ranked by Times Higher Education University Rankings, only 24% are held with a woman vice chancellor.
Wow.
Yeah. Yet, the global statistics, and I'm going to read this, at faculty representation in tertiary education shifted from 33% in 1990 to 43% in 2020. But now our leadership roles are missing. It's a huge gap. I mean, as I just stated to you, in Africa, we have 47% graduates. Women or girls are in higher numbers at entry-level tertiary education, even at high school level. And then we find that, oh, well, the big offices at universities only have 17% of leaders that are women. Let's look at South Africa as an example. Now, South Africa is an interesting phenomenon. We'll have our undergrad levels high, about close to 70%. Honors, 66%. go up to master's, then PhD drops to 50. Suddenly, you go up to leadership positions, it drops even further to 27%. Do you know there's only 7 vice chancellors out of 26 universities that are female in South Africa at this moment?
Sure.
Yes. We call this a phenomenon in the university system called a leaky pipeline. Mm-hmm. At each successive layer, we lose women. Hmm. I like to call it the drop to the top.
Yeah.
And our drop is in massive numbers. It's very scary. I'm going to quote further statistics. 40% of directorships at state-owned entities sit at 40%. 36% at professional services industries and 27% on JSE-listed companies. This is our harsh reality.
I'd love to add to that when you speak of that leaky pipe, because the additional crisis we have in South Africa is that only 4 to 6% of South African adults will have a university degree.
Yes.
And so what that means is we're talking about a leaky pipe on what is already a quite filtered small population of elites. And within those elites, we are underrepresented. And yet we've got 94% of people that are putting as their highest qualification, it's matric, it's, you know, some diploma and so forth. And yet there's an inversion when we talk of employability. The higher that qualification is, the more likely a person is to be employed. So now when we have a situation within that 94% where we have a lot of young women that are not breaking out of matric or a higher certificate into these specialist skills that essentially unlock opportunity, both in innovation, in entrepreneurship of businesses that will grow to scale, in leading JSE-listed enterprises, then essentially, from cradle through to, shall we call it, menopause, we're not getting the seat. And the numbers are dwindling, and at every level, the representation of women in dire statistics is disproportionate.
Yes.
And I think that's the crisis. If we're talking about framing the topic sentence, I think we have it there, which is, ladies, we've got a job to do.
We have a big job. And,
but I'm going to add the last element to framing the challenge. And I find this the most pitiful of all, is that when women do enter that C-suite, what do? They shut the door. They close the ring around the table. They don't want another woman coming through because they made it. But have they thought about mentoring someone else to climb in? And then the bullying and the harassment. And we only look at it from male to female. But what about female to female discrimination and harassment?
Yeah.
And those are very scary realities. We don't quote those statistics, but we know it's latent.
Yes.
It happens. It's a reality. We've always seen it in families. But seeing it in a boardroom is totally different.
And, you know, within our community, the Queen Bee Syndrome, you know, we don't want to talk about it because we don't want to give it oxygen.
Yeah.
But we have to talk about it because the Queen Bee Syndrome has an impact of how we get women there, and we need to have a purpose as to why we need more women there, because this is not just about us. As individuals, it's about us. I mean, if I look at everything that I've built with Conscious Leaders, it's been very hard for me to try and be as inclusive as I possibly can, because not everybody appreciates that. I don't want to compete with anybody. I want as many of us to be in co-opetition, to come together. Let's do this thing. And it is important to have that extension and to put that olive branch out and say, here we pull people up. Here there's no generational gatekeeping.
Yes.
Here we do things so we can empower us as a unit because our third spaces have disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
It's decreased, I think, over the 30 years, like massively. And the third spaces is the sacred spaces where we can unite. And women, when we look at the research, it's actually a podcast that we did on it. Women, when they face fear, they don't necessarily do the survival mode or flight, fight, or freeze. Women tend and befriend. But that has been removed from us as seeing each other as being in competition. But the anciently, women have always come together. But the psychologists are having huge debates now about this thing that women have around tending and befriending. Mm. And we need community. We need to come together and we need to create community even for women in STEM that we can be around. Every business is now a technology business. Mm. We can't look at it as STEM is outside of us. Oh, I'm not a technologist. We all need to become technologists. We all work with AI. It is part of who we are. But I'm paraphrasing now. I don't have the exact study in front of me, but something interesting that came across, your thread of your insights is there was a study done, I think it was in 2020 by McKinsey with 18,000 people within the workforce. And they found that the higher the education, the more you know about technology and more AI efficient you are. You're just maybe not as well efficient in software development.
Mm. Yes.
But the less humility you have, the less education you have, the more humility you have, but less efficiency in technology. And that's where the challenge comes in the age of misinformation, distrust. But the people with less education are the people that are sitting with the skills for the future.
Mm.
They handle with uncertainty much better than people on a higher level. They are the people that are more agile and flexible and adaptable. Like all of these soft skills that we are talking about. Yes. So there's something that needs to happen.
Yes.
Between those worlds.
I think something that intrigues me about this is something I've spent a lot of time pondering on. And I think you use the term the queen bee syndrome. And you know, it's something that I've thought about also in the context of African liberation struggles.
Mm.
And this is a decidedly unstatistic study that has occurred only in my head.
Love that!
Which is about the structural nature of filters that are in place in areas where there's underrepresentation as an outcome.
Yeah.
So if I put it another way, what does it take as a woman in a world that is built to limit your chances to make it there?
Mm.
So I think we can all agree that while 2% of women are receiving VC funding, we don't agree that, you know, when we've got little babies, women are less likely to be innovative. Women are less likely to have the resilience of an entrepreneur. Women are less likely to be, you know, STEM inclined. That's not true. And yet on the other end of the pipe, they are significantly less likely to be in that chair.
Mm.
And my question is, what are the things that prevent them from getting there? And what are the scars that the survivor bears? And how do the scars that the survivor bears influence the behaviors that become typical of the surviving population, if I can call it that?
Mm, mm.
And so on that survivor who is in fact, you know, survival is the other side of victim, right? On that survivor who is a survivor because they survived victimization, we then put the added burden of you had to punch through, you had to thicken your skin, you had to hunker down and then somehow find a soft place to still be a mother, to still be a daughter, to still be a sister, to still be someone's lover. Now, can you be empathetic to the stranger who just walked through the door?
Yes.
Who needs someone to walk them through the punching and the fighting and the thickening of skin, etc., etc.? And I'm not excusing certain behaviors that maybe in some instances I've been a victim of, possibly in some instances have been a perpetrator of. But what I'm saying is that it is structural. And the system doesn't just create exclusion by preventing us from getting there. I think the system makes it hard for us to still be warm and communal once we get there.
Yeah.
And it's not as easy as, Nyari, be a little bit more patient, be a little bit more generous. This road is rough. You know, this is a talk about women in STEM. If we turned it into a talk about war stories and gave each of us the mic for an hour, boy, do we have stories to tell.
Yes.
And how have we healed from those stories?
Yeah.
How have we looked deeply into what those stories have done to shape us, our perspective, what we deem to just be our irritations and our value systems and our positions of things? So Paul Kaleo in The Pedagogy of the Oppressed spends a lot of time on this issue of how oppression shapes the oppressed to imitate the persona of the oppressor. And this is why you see in liberation struggles a shift from an external oppressor, an uprising, a revolution, which then ends up with the leaders of the revolution perpetrating very similar behaviors to the oppressor that they risked their lives to depose. And so I think there's a similar complexity. And again, starting with the fact that this is a completely in my head study.
I'm no research papers. I love it.
And only, I guess, in my own soul searching. And I think that's part of the thing, which is to say, I noticed on the We Think Code campuses, when we had fewer women. So when I, you know, began as CEO of We Think Code, 13% of our campuses were young women training to be software engineers. And it's just harder when you're 13%. You walk in the room and it looks like you shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
Everyone in that room, male or female, white or black, has insecurities. But to be a young woman, to be black, to be from a family that doesn't understand technology and says you should be an accountant or a doctor or a whatever, and then get in there and then be insecure and then mess up, it almost feels like that mess up is a confirmation bias of everything you have fought against. And we realize that literally just having more women in the room creates an emotional safety that just starts to make it a little bit easier. And the women will bond and they will make connections, but they'll also make connections with the men more easily in an environment where they are not feeling like an alien the whole time.
Tamed and afraid.
And so I do think I have experienced women being harsh to me. I think if I'm being entirely honest as a woman leader, I've probably been harsh to young women coming up. But I think I look to the point of empathy and say, how do we make it not about the individual woman who fought to get into that chair and about how the system makes it hard for you to come out on the other side cuddly as a teddy bear?
I'm going to add to that, because what we're saying is very poignant. Getting there is not an easy journey either. And what you have to do is set boundaries. Because it's not all about being the soft and cuddly teddy bear, because everyone will want a piece of that pie.
And that's toxic kindness.
Exactly. So when you look at holistic woman, integrated woman, well-being, we have to be in that mental space where sometimes it's not family that's your community or your sisterhood. It is actually people who will bolster you and say to you, yes, you were wrong. You shouldn't have done that. But let's forgive ourselves. Let's embrace our new learnings of forgiveness. But this is why you have that protection. And it's sometimes that we become harder, or people become harder as they grow up on that ladder, career ladder, because it's about having that piece of mental sanity. And it is so important to find that balance. And before judging, we must also understand both sides of the coin. We've all watched Devil Wears Prada.
Yes, we all have. So relatable.
I mean, that's where it comes from.
Hurt people hurt people.
Heal people heal people.
Exactly. And the other thing I'd like to bring on it, because Nyari, you brought that up, is what did COVID show us? It showed us how to depend on ourselves. But it also made us long for human interaction. But when that human interaction came, we also wasn't just appreciative of it, but we also balanced it with safeguarding your inner peace. And I know the statistics always, especially in the high-tech world, is skewed to STEM graduates, especially our engineering graduates. But we must also remember, in Africa, more than any region in the world, have female-headed households. So how are we going to say, oh, well, it's 5 years to 2030, we need to have achieved the Sustainable Development Goals. If we empower women, gogos, in the community, we've addressed every single sustainable development goal. From using firewood and coal to prepare meals, to using now maybe electricity generated from renewable energy sources, as an example, solar panels, wind turbines. You know, have you ever read the book, The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind? A beautiful story. We look at economic growth, because whether it's a high-tech sector or a JC company, or whether it's a spaza shop or you're buying Cook Sisters from the side of the road, it's about digital literacy. access to the internet. Who doesn't have a Yoko? You know, because now hard currency is not what we are looking at. We are saying, oh, can we tap and go? This now trains our youth, the young ones, watching granny, watching the go-go in the household, cooking in this responsible manner and saying, this is the future I would paint to make her life easier or the woman in my life easier. If we also start with women, it's also about practicing safe hygiene. You know, how many girls don't go to school when they're on their period because they're using cloth? Yeah, they don't have access to toilets. We're using pit latrines. These are harsh realities.
It's basic human rights.
It's basic human rights, but it's not rights that are accessible to rural communities. Yeah. Even in South Africa, we still have what in the old days we called Bantu education, around matrix. We have rotating times for schools to convene. So you can go for the morning session or you go for the afternoon session because you don't have capacity or infrastructure and housing to hold a room full of students. So education is critically important. If we get those pillars right from the six-year-old, we can fix. And we can fix a number of these challenges. And one of those challenges, and I call it a disease that plagues not just South Africa, but the global South at large. And that's gender-based violence. Because we are such a matriarchal-based community in Africa. In the global South, actually, we always find there's always one matriarch that holds everyone together. Mm. But when men feel that they do not have that appropriate level of power, gender-based violence kicks in, or any form of abuse. But if we start with young kids and show them what respectful behaviors are, how do I respect my teacher? The same way I respect my gogo and mother at home, the same way I respect my sister, then we see that these kinds of respectful behaviors permeates into their DNA as they grow up and
mature
into
adults. I see where you're going with this. Yeah, because that will also then become a product of how coding happens in the world of technology now.
Correct. So inclusivity starts with boys and girls being brought to the table and educated appropriately, correctly, and respectfully about inclusivity.
I think I love what you're saying, and it takes me to this idea of, you know, when we talk about recruiting in any form into a training institution, into employment, we've always used proxies, right? So you give me your degree certificate, and that proxy is what you can do. This tells me that you sat still for 3 or 4 years. This tells me that you maybe learned something about accounting or law or something like that. It's a proxy. I'll discover in the theater of struggle whether the proxy I used to evaluate you is true. And so I remember coming out of high school, and I was in Zimbabwe at the time, and going into my articles. So I went straight from high school into working for Deloitte and was studying my degree by correspondence while working. And the things they used to evaluate, the proxies they were looking for is, you know, did you play sport? Because that tells me you're a team player. Maybe you were captain of the hockey team, because that tells me you've got leadership qualities. Maybe you are captain of hockey and public speaking. That tells me you have range, you know. And so that's how we proxy and then say, okay, this little busybody prefect, monitor, hockey captain, tennis player could be someone. She has grit, she has resilience, she has capacity. But what we don't do, and this came to mind when you were speaking, is give the same credit to people that come up in a different theater. Yes. So if you're a young woman and you are essentially raising your siblings, why isn't that something we can put on your CV and say, this tells us this young woman is a leader. This tells us she buried a parent young, survived that trauma, and went on to say, well, what can we do now? She has resilience. Mm. She was waking up at 5 in the morning, out to the field, then doing this before getting to school, and she passed with a C. She saw it through. That's the proxy of her capacity. Mm. And so why isn't that on her CV? And would AI know, if it saw it on her CV, to give it the credit that it is due? And so inclusion cannot happen if it's a single story. Inclusion cannot happen when Nyari's captaining a hockey team is graded above Cindy raising her siblings. And so there's an element here where the world is what it is.
Yeah.
But inclusion into economic systems, be they education as the pathway to, employment as the engine of, they are not designed to give respect to the theater where we did the learning. Mm. And I respect university. My degree has gotten me far. I run a training academy. I understand the importance of learning a trade. But I also understand that the precursor to that capacity to learn is a range of behavioral things mm-hmm. that are not just trained in one way. Mm-hmm. So women-led households tells us of a continent of women leaders. Mm. And yet the JSC doesn't reflect it in the statistics you shared. Our vice chancellors in universities don't reflect it in the statistics you shared. And yet we've got unrefuted evidence that the women on this continent are doing the most. Yeah. And so to speak to the concept of having food at home, we have women that are leaders, that show grit and innovation and have intuition and strength. We strip them of dignity and self-esteem by refusing to recognize the theater in which they were credentialized. Yeah. And if we can have that paradigm shift and honor their degree in the School of Hard Knocks, then we should very confidently open up the doors and say, the things I need to teach you are so much easier than the things you already arrived with.
Yeah.
You have what it takes to learn them. And I think that's the shift that's going to give us a world that not only includes women, but benefits from what they bring to the table when you give them their
just
position.
That's where business training,
position.
Entrepreneurship training is so critical.
Yeah.
Because those spaza shops are grannies, actually, or mothers trying to make ends meet. When you buy your cook sister on the way to work, you know, that is a woman-headed household trying to put food on the table. Yeah.
But I also just want to touch on another point, right? So if you look at masculine and feminine systems, right? A masculine system is hierarchy. It seeks all the answers. It's not about the journey. It's all about the destination. You know, it's very hierarchical and structural. Whereas when you look at the feminine side of a systems, it's more about the questions, right? Mm. It's more about the process. It's more about the journey. It's more about collaboration. Now, those things are important to note because if you look in our systems, our systems, artificial intelligence alone is all about providing us with answers, right? So now it's about the questions that you ask. Now, I learned last week something very interesting, that if you really want to get the best output out of AI, you have to emotionally manipulate it. Did you know that?
Mm-hmm.
So if you emotionally manipulate AI, you'll get better results. Bias. So all the things we as leaders are trying to unlearn, we now need to relearn and exercise on something artificial. Make that make sense to me. Make that make sense. That is very, very scary. For me, the other thing is, if we look at research, research is masculine and sterile. Mm. Go into a room, ask these questions, and there's no humanity because we have to be unbiased. You are being more biased because of the way that you are doing research.
Yes, yeah.
Your research is not capturing, to your point, Nyari, is the essence and the theater and the stories behind your living, your situation, and the resilience that you've had being raised. Then we, you know, if we look at the structures and human resources, and if, just earlier to the point when I was talking about Amazon's AI, that just because it had the word woman in it, didn't give women opportunities. Those things are showing us that we need more women in the entire system because this is not going to change. I can tell you now, within Conscious Leaders, we do research very differently.
Mm-hmm.
We have one-on-one conversations. I've done like a numerology session with each woman to say, this is what I'm seeing. And let me do a one-on-one coaching session with you in your numbers. Here's what I'm seeing. Now let's have a conversation around, what do you see in your world?
Mm.
We've opened up, built rapport, built trust. We have each other's best interests at heart. And now let's have a conversation.
Yeah.
The insights from those 2-hour interviews has shaped Conscious Leaders completely.
Wow.
It's because you get to the bottom of what and who you are. What is the story? What do you really think?
I don't want to hear what you think I need to know.
Mm.
It's very different. And this is how our systems are built. And that's why the data is skewed, because it's not showing us the real picture. And I think that as researchers, and you come from you know, Deloitte, and you know, those things are something that we need to start addressing from an educational perspective, yeah. because our research is not giving us the right insight to build the world we want, because we're not doing the research properly. So we need to look at the systemic thinking from root. What decisions are we going to make, and what data are we basing that on? Also, a lot of our research that we're looking at is a lot to do with what's happening in the other side of the world. We've seen that they've banned over 150 words. That includes us in the room. It includes everybody in Africa. Those words are now excluded in research, which means in a year or two from now, the research that we will be using does not have us in mind.
I think what technology does, like, imagine a world. Okay, now I'm John Lennon. Imagine a world where the data is secure. Let's assume that, which it isn't always. There's a lot of abuse of people's data. So let's imagine a world where the data is secure. And you have people all over the continent, and women in particular, their thoughts, their ideas, digitized and online. Suddenly, when we're mining data systems, because the key thing that happens with AI is it's a whole lot of fancy math.
Mm.
And the fancy math is playing back to us a specific snapshot that is reflective of the data pool in which information is.
Mm.
And so if that data pool is concentrated, you know, to one particular group of people, it biases to that group of people. And you know, you talked about it in terms of the facial recognition, in terms of the hiring stats, what shows competence and what have you. You know, and I'm going to go back to my stories with the go-go's and whatnot. But if I think of my grandmother, who is not literate and was a maid, but she raised three girls and got them through school, my mom and her sisters. And she did everything from crocheting and selling doilies to selling tomatoes to doing whatever she did. I am a trained accountant. I do not understand how that woman with that income earned in that marketplace with those products stood up what she stood up.
Mm.
But I will confidently walk up to her and say, Gogo, I'm going to teach you about financial literacy. And I'm like, girl, teach me. Teach me how those ends met when I have been courtesy of your sacrifice, overqualified, over earning in comparison to you and running out of money. Like, if my grandmother had earned like I earn, I wonder what she would have done, you know?
Exactly.
And so I think part of it is there's this binary thing we create, like about a feminine system versus a masculine system.
Yeah.
A system with formal education versus a system with informal education, right? A system with training versus a system without training. And yet the reality is muddled. Even the way we talk about STEM, for example. My partner is an English major, and he is a master with words, and he's an art collector, and he's completely the opposite of my accounting bullet points list, cross it out, is it done brain, which makes for a lot of fun arguments. But essentially what you learn from that as well is when I was in high school in Zimbabwe and I finished my O-levels and I want to pick my A-levels, you had to make a decision. Are you going to do science subjects or are you going to do what they call art subjects? So it's either you went and you studied something like geography, business management, you know, maybe you did some divinity or thesis type stuff, or you did maths, chemistry, biology, etc. I wanted to do English literature, an art subject, and mathematics. I literally broke the timetable because it was like, what is that? It's either you're doing maths and then after that you go to chemistry, or you're doing English literature and after that you go to geography. Now this crazy one wants to go to maths over here and English literature over there, and that doesn't make any sense. And yet when I look at what my life is now, the ability to communicate, the ability to analyze that I learned in English literature, and my mathematical kind of analytical brain that's reductive and logical on the other side, the combination of that is needed for me to be effective in what I am. So when we talk about women, we tend to describe these empathetic, warm people that are interested in the journey and not just the outcome. And yet when you look at parenting, you know, mothers are both. Like, they will kill for their kids. They will die for their kids. Mm. But that love doesn't always manifest in hugs and kisses and, oh, my kid is perfect. It's boundaries.
Yes.
It's sternness. It's, I am readying you for a world that isn't out to help you like I am. And so they are balancing that sense of their steps to take with blowing the scrape on the knee, which is not a scientific mechanism of healing.
Yeah.
But with also the scientific mechanism of get to school and do what you need to do. Yeah. So in truth, women have always had this balance and this chameleon tendency of what is needed in what setting. Yeah. We just choose to forget it when she says, I can't make it to work because I've got to take my kid to the hospital.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yet what she is doing is juggling these two sides. The side that says, step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, strict boundaries. Softness, cuddles, need to make sure your insides are taken care of while your outsides are governed. Yes, yes. And I think if we recognize that duality in all of us, that little bit
of art, little bit of numbers, little bit of story. Because what I'm trying to also just to highlight and point out to you, remember I'm referring to divine, like feminine and masculine systems, not necessarily man, woman.
Okay.
We're not talking gender roles here. And I think it's a very important point because we have both in each one of us. Like if I set a boundary, that is a masculine trait.
Expression,
an expression. And if I cuddle and huddle and all of that kind of thing, that is the feminine side of me. Yeah. But I think the importance, exactly to your point, is we all have both in us. But I think we're in the system that we are operating in is patriarchal.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Masculine.
Yes.
And all of the traits that come with it. And that is why if we all, man and woman, start tapping into being more feminine.
Correct.
That's going to help solve this problem.
Mm-hmm. I think the challenge therein is that we live in a world that's been made by men, for men, to advance. Yeah, you will find that in all the rules and the rule books. How do you have to fight a little bit harder to earn a degree in engineering just to, you know, make it? Or mining, as an example. And what Nyari is saying is actually very important because we are seeing the agility of women. Regardless of the shifting face and the evolution of economies to thrive, strive and nurture.
Yeah.
Which is what you were talking about, that sacred feminine drive, that sacred feminine core. And what we do, and you said this earlier, that we have these algorithms fixed on American successes. Mm-hmm. We need to now, and I'm hoping with your school, that you would be able to shift the algorithm to say, how do we in Africa, in the global South, you know, because South Americans do this, Indians do this, Aborigines in Australia do this. They don't just live on the land. They live with the land.
Yes. Yes.
You know, and there's something important about that because we have niche crops. We have medicinal plants. Even when we're sick, how often is it you're going to go use Vicks first or eucalyptus oil?
Oh, I'm
oil
a Vicks girl, me up.
You know, Sambac, all of those kinds of things. We are going to get our medicines first from the land. From, are we honoring that in the way in which we design? And this is where we call about a rethinking, redesigning, reshaping how we do research. Yeah. Right? And do we include the communities? Do we include the indigenous people? Do we include the indigenous knowledge that we know is passed down through narratives? And of course, growing up, you know, for us, it's ginger and turmeric tea that we'd make when someone's ill. Oh, I'm taking it now at the moment. But that recipe, where am I putting it? We've got Starbucks or whatever other coffee shop that's now calling it yellow milk or something latte.
Yeah.
Sunshine something. Yeah. But where does its roots come from? Yeah. You've commercialized something. And is there any acknowledgement to where that information comes from? So what you say is very true. Yeah. Algorithms are skewed, but to a very Western philosophy.
Yeah, and individualism.
Correct.
Oof. Yeah.
Yeah. And whereas for us, it's always about community, storytelling.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is how you fix a flu. This is how you fix a headache. This is how you fix someone falling down. With natural medicines first, or remedies.
Yeah.
So let's start reshaping that African discourse.
Yes.
And I think that's critically important as we prepare the future generations.
Yes.
How do we educate that? How do we change that? And how do we shift men from defining those policies repeatedly so?
Yeah, and ethically as well. And I mean, like, it's so true. Like, there's a wisdom deficit.
Yes.
And we are seeing that more and more people are going, I'm no longer seeking information. I'm seeking wisdom. I'm seeking wisdom. And this is what's not in the system unless you ask the right questions, right?
Yes.
If you're willing to seek that wisdom. So I totally agree with that. But I also want to go back to what Nyari said, and she flew over that one so quickly. But I want to come back to it. You spoke about something so profound that I think that especially we as women need to teach women in STEM and women finding themselves in their new career is finances.
Mm-hmm.
Is the roles and responsibility, baby daddy's not paying, I'm responsible for the child, I have to take care of the family, I have a lot more responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Who is financially including her and educating her on how to manage her finances over and above this complex industry? Because, you know, it's very easy when the moment you land a nice fat big check, sustainable thinking, because there's actually the reverse to this, where there was a research study that was done that showed for every 1% decline in economic stability,
mm-hmm.
there's like a 1.7, or I paraphrase, a 1.7 decrease in sustainability efforts.
Mm.
So every time when somebody is not making it financially and have to meet ends meet, they are not going to care about sustainable development goals and buying products and services that's good for the environment and all of those kind of things.
We're looking at you.
The floor is open.
Yes, I think these are critical areas we need to start thinking of, because women also, as you said, when their baby daddy is not paying, mm-hmm. and you have a baby or you are pregnant, what happens? Let's look at this male-structured environment. Number one, they're giving you a part-time job on a temporary contract.
Mm-hmm.
As if inflation is going to not affect you in any way. Number one. Number two is these products that you're looking for in environmental sustainability, conservation of the planet. Are we actually addressing them? No, because it's about survival. What is the cheapest product to get?
Mm-hmm.
And we are seeing this even in the science sector. Huh? These are educated PhDs, single moms. Guess what happens? We'll say, oh, you want to take time off? You want to go home to the village? Your mom's taking care of you. Your granny's taking care of you. Fine, go have your baby. Come back. Guess what? You no longer considered a young researcher, mm-hmm. what they call an early career academic. Why? Because government has prescribed that it's 35 years is the cutoff age.
Sure.
For you to get any of those benefits. Right. Then you get hit with the discrimination issue. What? Oh, you're leaving early again. Ah, yes. Childcare supports are not quite working. Huh? Yes. So what do? We now use a structured performance review system that hits you on HR. Why? Because you're not performing. You leave work early.
Mm-hmm.
And women are not saying cut us slack on our deadlines.
Mm-hmm.
We need flexible time. We'll meet the deadline.
Mm-hmm.
Just allow us to accommodate children,
mm-hmm.
cooking, and whatever else that we need to do in the day.
Mm.
We'll meet it. It may be 5 minutes to 12 mm-hmm. midnight, but we'll get your document or your research or whatever else needed. So this is the harsh reality. So whether you're looking at people with an education or people without an education, women are literally screwed over. Mm-hmm. On top of it, say they come back and now they accelerate in terms of achieving all their publications and milestones. Then, boom, they get the glass ceiling. Oh, well. This is where I will make reference to that picture I shared with you earlier, Carmen. So I'm going to firstly make reference to this picture. And basically, the playing ground is not equal mm-hmm. for women. Simple as that. In their late 20s, they're into their PhD and postdoc years. From an academic perspective, what happens? Women branch out and they have kids. Men are still going full time. So when they come back, as an example, men have already earned their miles for career progression, for getting that promotion, for getting a full-time permanent job. What happens to women? Women are stuck. Half-day jobs, short-term contracts, lower pay. Yet, we just said the statistics are it's a woman-headed household is a reality in Africa. Then you come home, it's the cleaning, it's the washing, it's the cooking, it's the feeding, it's the homework, it's the driving around, and this is in a non-rural setting. Mm-hmm. This is a city setting. And then you have a child that's sick. What happens? You still have to pitch up at work. Who's going to be your childminder? Mm. And this is the hurdles on the racetrack to achieving goals for women. It's a harsh and it's a bitter reality. The other reality that not many women in South Africa, Africa know of is pink tax. Have you gone for grooming products and seen that your husband's razor is like 30, 35, 50 rands less than yours? Same with the deodorants as mm-hmm. an example. Do you know in South Africa alone, we pay sanitary towels to the value of 30 billion rand a year?
Sure.
We have a very advanced national treasury because they removed VAT on sanitary towels in 2019. But of course, the supermarkets kept the price the same because of profit margins. Flip it around. If women also need to have access to contraceptives and control their own reproductive health, what are the hurdles? You have to go to the GP, pay the GP, get the script, then go to the pharmacy and give it to them and then pay the extra fee because your medical aid may or may not pay for it, just so that you can have an informed lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
This is the cost of what it is like to be a woman. And we forget that because the pink tax is a reality that actually persecutes us for being women mm-hmm. rather than supporting us for having this unique capability of being nurturers of life,
mm-hmm.
of educating the future generation, whether it's through formal structures or informal structures. Women are persecuted, yeah. and that's the harsh reality.
And it's so true because the system has not been built for women. So from one season to the other, as women are climbing themselves up to this mountain, they are just faced with obstacles. So true to your point. Mm-hmm. So we as women play such an important role in society, and we should never think that we don't.
Mm.
But this conversation around STEM has been so important. So I really want us to bring this all together, based on everything that we've discussed. We framed the problem. We looked at why women, why we need them in Africa, what's happening on the ground and the challenges that women are facing, that want to get into STEM and what we need to take into consideration and also the burdens that come with being a woman in Africa. But also building tech for Africa by Africans mm-hmm. for African problems. Organizations need to start looking towards how do we turn Africa into the grandmaster as mm-hmm. empires are falling around the world?
Mm-hmm.
How do we prepare for Africa's time? Because Africa's time is now. Africa to rise. But with that, we need to bring women with us on this journey. And this is something that we're passionate about. But what work do we need to start doing within the technology space and the science space? You know, even in within innovation, STEMI, as you put it earlier, which is STEM plus the I for innovation. What is the strategy and the mandate?
I think, you know, hope is an important ingredient to moving forward and to persistence. And where I find hope is in what we do have. You know, I keep going back to my mother's mantra, there's food at home. So we're not stopping by the fast food spot. But there's some things we know. We talked about the demographic dividend. Africa has a youthful population. 60% of South Africa's population is youth, which means we have a lot of young people at that age where their minds are ready and open to learn. Granted, in the current construct, not enough is being done to ensure that those young people are in education, are in training, are in employment so that they can be contributors. But we've got the population. Two, we've spoken a lot about how we are excluded from these, if I can call them frontier technologies. Our data isn't training the algorithms that are giving us the AI. Our young people that are pinned into rural communities and underprivileged communities aren't accessing digital technology, especially not in an educational or economically empowering manner. But the truth is that those technologies have made it easier.
Yes.
So 50, 60 years ago, to learn was to go to a school, and the school was a building, and that building was far away. Today, to learn is to be able to access a hive mind of knowledge, which devices and data access can make possible. And so it's about systematically looking and saying, if the humans are there, and the technology that we're excluded from now in terms of mass access is actually an enabler of the population that is there. How do we shift things around? How do we look at universities as places of frontier learning and knowledge, but then decentralize how we access the learning that these research institutions with these professors are building so that not everybody gets a degree, but a lot more people get a competence? How do we rewrite the story of what is competence? And importantly, how do we make sure that young women, yes, understand that their journey, the difference between them and the girl in the private school, is that the girl in the private school knows how to own those experiences and define how they build her capacity. How do we empower these young women to say, my journey, my experience, its trauma, its joys are relevant to the capacitation of what I can contribute to the world? And then importantly, there's an issue of allyship. In the same way we talked about allyship of women who make it through and the importance of getting on the other side and pulling others in with you, so lift as you rise. Men have to come to this table. I imagine patriarchy is exhausting for men. It's not all roses to carry that.
I think they like it, though.
Oh, the rates of the rates of depression and suicide among middle-aged men tell us we've got a society in crisis.
And I just want to add to that. It's 80%, hey? 80% of the suicide rates in South Africa is men.
Men, middle-aged men in their 50s.
Is it not men at retirement?
In their 50s. In their 50s. And so you realize that we're in this together.
Yes.
You are your brother's keeper, you are your sister's keeper.
Yes.
And it's balance we seek. And balance is not precisely two for you, two for me today. It might be one for you, three for me today, four for me, zero the other day, four for you, zero. You know what I mean? It's contextual.
Yes.
And the important thing is we've got to realize that we're in it together. Studies show us that teams in technology that are diverse by gender outperform teams that are just all smart boys from the Ivy League, right? So we know that economically it's the right thing to do. Ethically, we know that it's the right thing to do. In terms of solutions, we know that when we build solutions with people with a different perspective, I mean, look at this conversation. Mm-hmm. You can see how your academic experience, your experience in marketing and communication, my experience in a nonprofit that's trying to bring up engineers, creates a dialogue that I couldn't have had with two other women that are from exactly the world that I am in. Mm-hmm. And so we've got to start to realize that diversity is a power, youth is a dividend, and the technology we have today enables us to leapfrog, and the word is overused, but definitely to leapfrog and address this exclusion, leveraging how tech can make things accessible. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what excites me about the moment, and that's what keeps me hoping. Because without hope, I mean, what have we got? You know. So I think I work with a lot of young women that didn't think that they could be engineers, that are now engineers and doing amazing things. I remember one particular young woman who joined our academy, and she got pregnant while she was in training and had her baby and took some time off, came back from maternity leave, had her mom supporting her and looking after the baby at home, and she pushed through. Yeah. Was it tougher for her than a young woman who wasn't a mother? Absolutely. But she doubled down. And by making provisions available for her to study from home for some time, to take some time off, to give an opportunity to catch up. I remember when she was placed at one of the largest banks in South Africa, I was sitting in the office opposite where our employment placements manager sits. And they're having a conversation and I heard a squeal. And I looked up like, what's wrong? What's going on? The delight and the tears, which is she wasn't looking for a shortcut. She wasn't looking for an excuse. She was looking for an opportunity.
Yeah.
And she was looking for a structure and a system that honored her reality. And I think if we can do that, women are ready to shift and shake. They have been shifting and shaking. What we're looking for is an opportunity to enter the broader arena and contribute what we've always contributed in the homes. And I think it will give us economic prosperity. It will give us social cohesion. And that's what we're all after, is, you know, world peace. Yes. And I think
100%.
This is the way to it. We've been saying it in the beauty pageants. Now can we say it in the field of STEM? And so I think I'm excited about what's possible. I'm excited about girl dads that are aspiring for their daughters to be as great as their sons and that are starting to look at the world critically and are coming in as sincere allies because they realize quite urgently that they have skin in this game.
Yeah.
And so I think we're going to get it done together. Africa needs it, but importantly, the world needs Africa's solutions. And so our frugality, our practicality, our holistic sense of what is success, I think that is a muti that we need to export. Yeah. And so I'm excited. I don't think it'll be easy, but I think conversations like this are starting to happen. They weren't happening before. And I think young women are starting to step up and step into their own power. I think men are starting to see the importance of women stepping into their power. And so I do think there's a shift. And I think technology is an enabler for that shift. And I'm excited to be a part of trying to move that forward.
So before we move to you, final word.
Yeah.
To students
yes.
and to protect to potential women that want to enter STEM, what's the advice?
Do it. Do it. Start. The worst that will happen is you're really bad at it. And from a woman in her 40s, I can tell you, you're going to be bad at a lot of things in your life, but it will not be full if you don't try. And I think there's a perception of tech being for boys. Tech is for people that are analytical, that are diligent, that want to solve problems. And if that's you, just go for it.
Wonderful. Beautiful. Love that.
I love what you're saying. And it's so inspiring. And now that you've spoken about the technology side, let me talk about the capacity side. And, you know, and I gather this is where I've started the Women in Science program at the University of Pretoria, because I've seen younger women grapple. Why? Because your biological clock and your career path are in total conflict with one another. You choose one, the other suffers. You choose the other suffers. It's a no-win situation. And this is where you need to call on the sisterhood. And so when I started the Women in Science program, it was actually just a community of early career academics to create that sisterhood, peer-to-peer learning, networking. But as it's grown, we've had some great keynote speakers, Tuli Madonsela, Karisha Abdul-Karim. This year, we're very proud. We've partnered with L'Oreal, and we've got the Deputy Minister, Gina, from the Department of Science and Technology coming through as our keynote speaker. And what we're seeing now is that youngsters, whether it's at high schools, whether it's from communities, they want to come through because they want to have access to the inspiring stories. How did you get there? What did you do to get there? Can I have a little bit of that inspiration? Because that's the currency that's going to shape the future generations. And the second part I would say is, if I could wave a magic wand for the women I see daily, it would be to make sure they all have access to leadership, business training. Because not everyone's born to be an academic. You need to venture out and create job opportunities, become an entrepreneur, create a startup, create businesses, feed the economy. And that's your legacy. Of course, we do need our academics, but I'm just saying there's a flip side to that coin. you know, some of the exciting innovations that happened over our lifetime has actually been led by women. Dishwasher, mm-hmm. home security system, mm-hmm. The solar panels, the, well, it was part of a team, and space propulsion systems. I mean, these are all driven by women. How often do we hear their stories? And this is what we need to Beautiful. Do. We need to tap into this capability. Fixing the leaking pipeline also requires access to mentors. And I say paid mentors, because these high-flying mentors that say, oh, yes, I'm going to be your mentor. And guess what? Try plug me in a diary. And I have many stories about this. You come at 7:30 and then, oh, I forgot about it. Please come at 10 o'clock. Yeah, come 10 o'clock, they can't enter an executive meeting. Oh, we'll meet at lunch. And here you have a young researcher coming through saying, I've given up my whole day. Mm-hmm. Lab work, teaching work, all kinds of work to sit here and I'm waiting. And it doesn't happen once off. It happens repeatedly. So mentors need to also know when they step into that role, what is it that you are putting on the table? Mm. And I find that that usually is the challenge we face. You asked Nari, and I gather you're going to ask me the same, as what would be my passing words. I would like to say that, you know, we've come a long way from 1956, where those 20,000 women marched to union buildings. We honor their legacy because they've shaped our lives. Mm-hmm. We can walk after hours. There's no, curfew for us anymore. We have a right to vote. So we thank those, our ancestral lineage, basically, in South Africa. But as we do so, we must also remember the women that were on, just a year ago, she was on the top 50 most inspiring women in South Africa. She was actually listed on the Forbes 100. Do you know who I speak of? It's Didi Lekhanyane. And she was tragically killed in a relationship through gender-based violence. So as we tread along, we must remember our heroes and our heroines that walked before us. And you've both rightfully said, in my career, as an example, it's men who oftentimes open that door. Mm. It's not always a woman. So we need to make sure there's more men that are out there that are allies as well. It's a 50-50 percentage population when you look at it globally. So everyone has to come to a party to make sure we do have a gender equal future, not just for us, but for our children and our grandchildren and the leaders of tomorrow.
I love that. And you know, if this was a simulation of a boardroom meeting, then I don't know. But we were sitting here discussing the future of Africa, the future of our girls, the future of STEM. And you know, the important role they play for Africa to pivot. Mm-hmm. And not just for society's sake, but also for global peace's sake. We need that balance in order to shape the future that we want, to bring the wisdom back that we need in order to shape the future. And I'm so honored and I'm so grateful that you poured your heart, and thank you so much for the research that you've done and the in your head studies that you brought to the table. I love that. To our audiences, I just want to say thank you so much for sticking around. This was for you a status update, what you need in order for you to make better decisions in the boardroom, beyond the boardroom, in your day-to-day job, but also to be informed in how you can bring more STEM into your CSI initiatives. How can you drive more impact? How can there be more diversity and inclusion? How are we ensuring that AI mastery and AI fluency, that we are also checking AI ethics and biases and seeing how that is showing up in our technology and how we can make sure that we make better decisions for the future by interrogating our systems and our processes. So from my side, I just want to say bye-bye now. Thank you.